Okay, I think we want to get started. Hopefully everybody outside will hear my voice and start to mosey on into the room. I'm Mike Rice from Defined Health. I'm a senior consultant at Defined Health. I spend about half my time in oncology and the rest in rare disorders and different areas. And I've been with Defined Health about 10 years, and I realized that, you know, when we were preparing for this panel, that we haven't been asked by many of our clients to look at specifically developing drugs for pediatric indications. We do a lot of work in understanding rare disorders, and in the non-oncology space, monogenic diseases, we do a lot of work in pediatric indications. But within oncology, it's usually as a subset of a broader program. And so out of, I think I looked back about 500 or so oncology assessments that we've done in the last 10 years, I can think of maybe one or two that we've actually looked at a specific pediatric population. And one of that was in collaboration with Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, where we helped them look across unmet needs across all of blood cancers and to look beyond what is considered an unmet need, like pediatric ALL, given that there's approaching 90% 7-year event-free survival rate, but look beyond that, see what other needs there are. I had to dig around yesterday to come up with some material to talk about, you know, just to give an introduction, but there are only maybe now probably about 20 pediatric indicated oncology drugs that are approved by the FDA, even though there is, many drugs that are used in children, almost entirely evidence-based medicine and off-label use of those drugs. Many drugs are very, very old. There's only been, a few that were first approved in children in the last two decades. But, you know, according to when I looked in the pipeline, there are about, 67 or so that I could easily identify as being pediatric development programs for new drugs. So it may change in the future. And so I just want to look at a few of these drugs to see what they look like. So here are the top in the box are the ones that that were first approved in pediatrics. Last week was the Unituxin, which I know a little bit about because it was just recently approved. It looked like a very interesting collaboration between the Children's Oncology Group and the NCI to get it approved. But beyond that, we look at all the other drugs that, first got approved in an adult patient population and subsequently got approved in pediatric patient population. There's a significant lag from, some cases a decade or more, but probably on average we see 4 or 5 years. The last one on this list, Afinitor, I thought that was sort of an interesting example because it looked like they did a good job at, getting first approved in relapsed refractory RCC. A year later, getting approved for both adult and children for SEGA. A year later, they actually got a pediatric formulation of it approved. So it seemed to be much more of a complex, comprehensive pediatric plan. Just at face value, I don't know if that's, exactly what really happened there. But regardless of not having a lot of innovation of pediatric drugs, through incremental innovation, we've been able to reduce pediatric mortality by 50%. Over the last several decades. And much of this, as I said, was trial and error incremental advancement. If we look at, a case of pediatric ALL over the last, since the 60s, incremental innovation, trying combinations and different sequences of old cytotoxics, and coming up with different schemes for induction, consolidation, maintenance, and dose intensification, better protocols for going on for salvage transplants. We've really dramatically improved the chance for survival for pediatric ALL. There's still considerable need in adult ALL that it has much worse outcomes. And, you know, just a little figure, you know, so why is it important to understand pediatric cancer and prioritize child-centered drug development programs? Just a little snapshot of some of the stuff that we've done with the Leukemia Lymphoma Society. We kind of broke out acute lymphoblastic leukemia and many other heme malignancies as well, and looked across that, and we see there's very, very different and divergent unmet needs from infants to the elderly, whereas the elderly, you know, we're looking for things that, you know, can elicit responses without, you know, the patients not being able to tolerate the toxicities of it. You know, down to, you know, pediatrics, where we see that there are different molecular drivers of disease. We have to understand better, you know, what are appropriate drugs that might improve the standard of care beyond just applying what we learned from adults to kids. There are different toxicities that we see. It was a lot of concern from clinicians that we heard about side effects of even something like Gleevec, you know, affecting growth and bone maturation and other things in the patients. And you know, any of the targeted therapies that, you know, we need to learn more about the consequence in a growing and developing child. And you know, when we get into things like you know, adolescent and young adults, when patients are transitioning from their parents managing them to their, you know, their self, there are things like compliance issues and other sort of things that, you know, need to be considered with optimizing care. But so that one last thing. So when we look at the drugs that are available for treating childhood cancers, you know, they are very old. Most of them are over 25 years. They're old. There are a few new ones that have been recently approved, but in the main, they're quite old and mostly genericized. We don't see a lot of investment, and you know, as I kicked it off, that we don't do a lot of work in pediatric cancers is just, you know, following because industry is not, you know, investing in the space. And so I think that's about it. So I just wanted to give a sort of brief little introduction of, you know, what, you know, we don't know about developing pediatric oncology drugs. And And we have a great panel that brings a lot of expertise from, you know, the clinical development standpoint, patient management, from understanding the policy and regulatory side, and how industry is working and advocating to gain access to children for drugs, both within, you know, the development programs, you know, as well as other ways to expedite drug development for rare and pediatric cancers. So with that said, I'd like to hand it over to Peter Adamson from the Children's Oncology Group and Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
Thanks, Mike. As Mike said, I'm Peter Adamson, and I'm a pediatric oncologist and clinical pharmacologist at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. And my primary role right now is to lead the Children's Oncology Group that I want to share some information about with you. But let me fill in some of the gaps in Mike's important introduction. Childhood cancer is often pointed to as a success story of medical research, and the outcome for children with our most common cancer, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, really drives that. But that really doesn't tell the story. So a few facts. Childhood cancer remains the leading cause of death from disease in children in this country. Cancer is a leading cause of death from disease in children in the country. So despite our progress, that's where we are. More importantly, if you look at our treatments, and Mike covered that we were able to make incredible progress with drugs approved in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But if you look at our treatments today for children with high-risk cancers, be it high-risk leukemias, high-risk solid tumors, 4 out of 5 children at some point during treatment experience severe, life-threatening, or fatal toxicity. 80% of children, severe, life-threatening, or fatal. Nowhere else in medicine, you know, would that be considered acceptable. We've gotten very good as a community in pediatric oncology in managing severe life-threatening toxicities, but it's not where we need to be. But probably as importantly, we have now over 350,000 survivors of childhood cancer alive in the U.S. about half of those children are experiencing a severe long-term effect of therapy. So when we treat a developing child, we know we're looking at what we hope is a trajectory of a lifespan of 70 to 80 years. About half of those patients have a severe consequence of therapy. So there's an urgent need to improve the treatment across the board for childhood cancer, ranging from improving the cure rates. There's certainly diseases that have not paralleled ALL, to lessening both the acute as well as chronic toxicities. The Children's Oncology Group, I think, is a remarkable organization that evolved over about a 60-year period. And I think there are lessons that can be learned from the Children's Oncology Group, because we are going to have a lot of company in the upcoming years. All we deal with are rare cancers. Our most common cancer has an incidence of about 2,500 cases a year in the U.S. We do research in cancers with an incidence of less than 50, and sometimes as few as 20 cases a year in the U.S. As we molecularly subdivide more common cancers, we don't think you'll get down to 20 in medical oncology, but we do think that we're going to have company in the rare disease space. So the COG currently has over 230 member institutions. It's predominantly U.S. and Canada, but we are global, Australia, New Zealand, parts of Europe. We collaborate with similar consortia in Europe, but there's some unique features for the COG. We're predominantly funded by the NCI, but not exclusively. We do have some philanthropic support and increasing collaboration with industry partners. More than 90% of children in this country are cared for at one of our institutions. So we are about as close to a population-based research enterprise as you will see. Now, 90% of children don't participate in research, but a very high fraction of children do. In the younger age group, more than 60% of children are enrolled in a clinical trial. It begins to fall off as we get into adolescence. And as I've said to many organizations, pediatric oncology and research evolved hand in hand over this 60-year period. And if you want to see a pediatric oncologist panic, you let them know there's a new patient in clinic and there's not an open study. That sets off panic. So that's how closely clinical research and the importance of clinical research is to the pediatric oncology community. Science, of course, is evolving at a much faster pace today, as everyone knows, than 10, 20 years ago, and the number of new agents in the clinical development pipeline has increased by orders of magnitude relative to the 1980s. What we've done with the Children's Oncology Group with respect to early phase development is try to restructure ourselves to streamline our processes and to be able to partner more effectively with industry colleagues. One thing that we realized would be of value added is that we are able to execute a single contract agreement and deliver 230 sites. We know, and I know firsthand on the receiving end, a great deal of time can be spent in contract negotiations. With advances coming quickly in some areas, we think it's value added, and we have a flexible model. There are trials that we do not need 230 sites. We have a phase one consortium for first and children's study that's 21 sites in the U.S. and Canada. But our model is flexible, and we've partnered successfully both domestically as well as globally, delivering anywhere from 20 to all 200-plus sites in clinical trials through a single contractual mechanism. Obviously, for us, time is of the essence, and we are directly dependent on primarily the adult cancer drug pipeline for what comes to children. We do look for what is most rational and most important as far as prioritization for our drugs moving into the pediatric space. Not all drugs that are in the medical oncology space are relevant to pediatric oncology, but despite that, or in spite of that, not every drug that's being developed for children, for adults, should we look at in children. The regulatory landscape that you'll hear about from Meredith in a few minutes is evolving. Right now, it is primarily driven from the EMA, from the European Medicines Association. That has had some unintended consequences that we've written about, but that's what's driving a lot of what goes on, is to try to meet the pediatric investigation plans and the PIPs, and we very much are aware of those and have experience in developing those. Let me just briefly follow up on one of Mike's slides, and that was last week. There was a drug that was approved, Unituxin, which is an antibody against an antigen that's highly expressed on neuroblastoma. That approval was based on Children's Oncology Group data, two pivotal trials and early phase trials that began in the 1990s, and then ultimately a partnership with the company United Therapeutics. It is a remarkable story because it is the first in children approval probably in over a decade. Most of our work are secondary or supplementary NDAs, SNDAs, but Unituxin was the first in children. The other reason I want to mention it is, and Meredith may touch upon this as well, but there is a legislative initiative that's now, I think, 2.5 years old, called the Creating Hope Act. The Creating Hope Act provides an incentive in the form of a priority review voucher at the FDA for a first-in-children indication. The first voucher was in a rare metabolic disease. What's important about these vouchers is that they're negotiable. They don't apply to the rare drug. They apply to whichever drug you'd like it to be used for. That voucher was sold for $67 million. Unituxin received a voucher as well. So it is an economic incentive of sorts that we hope will stimulate development for first in children, recognizing that the markets themselves probably cannot stimulate the drug development initially for these rare indications. But our ability to study rare populations, I think, is really unprecedented when you look across not just the cancer landscape, but all of drug development landscape. So it is an exciting time, I think, in the cancer drug development arena for children with cancer. There are indeed challenges as far as the types of cancers we develop drugs for tend to be relatively mutationally silent compared to the adult cancers, and thus sequencing and genomics efforts are likely not to address the fundamental problems with a significant fraction of our cancers. Nonetheless, we are defining molecular subtypes. We're doing it at diagnosis in many cancers, and our trials are evolving that at diagnosis we are identifying patients who have a molecular feature that we can quickly move to a relevant clinical trial of a targeted agent. So with that, I think I'll stop and...
Are we going down the line here?
Yeah, well, so I think I'd like to introduce Carlos Rodriguez-Galindo next, sort of following up on, you know, so how do you, you know, take what the COG, you know, is doing and make that more actionable and, you know, what sort of things are actually doing in clinical development, and how's that translating into patient management?
Yeah, so happy to follow Peter. So my name is Carlos Rodriguez-Galindo. As Mike and Peter said, I am a pediatric oncologist as well. I work in Boston, where I am a part of the pediatric oncology program and the director of the clinical trials program as well. So I have another hat that I wear, which is within the Children's Oncology Group, where I am the chair of the rare cancers group. So as Peter said, you know, pediatric cancers are rare by definition, so it's only 1% of all cancers occur in children, so that's pretty rare. So in adults, you probably count the most common cancers by the hundreds of thousands in the United States, right? Every year, hundreds of thousands of breast cancers, hundreds of thousands of colon cancers. In pediatric oncology, all cancers together make up less than 13,000. So our common cancers are in the high hundreds. The most common cancer may be leukemias, right, in the 2000s. So then you go down the line, and then every single cancer for which we need to develop a strategy, we need to develop a clinical trial, and Peter mentioned we try to put all these patients in trials, are in the low hundreds. So the most common solid malignancies, for example, sarcomas, 300 cases of rhabdomyosarcoma every year, maybe 600 of Wilms tumors or neuroblastomas. Then you go down, and then you get in the low digits, right? And when you talk about rare cancers, which is the committee that I try to lead, we're trying to develop clinical trials for cancers that are in the, you know, low hundreds. So hepatoblastoma, 150 cases every year, and yet, you know, Peter and I spent 1 hour before this talk, because before this session, trying to figure out how to optimize a trial that will have four different strata. And we're talking about hepatoblastoma with 150 cases a year. So a trial that is further subdivided in one in six or four strata, it's kind of challenging. And then we have trials for diseases that are even less frequent. Nasopharyngeal carcinoma, for example, 50 cases a year. Adrenocortical carcinoma, 25, 28 cases a year. So we don't forget about these cancers. These cancers are as important as an acute lymphoblastic leukemia to us. So we need to optimize these numbers, optimize the clinical trials. This is a challenge for clinical trial design, as you can imagine. How are you going to measure your outcomes and your success? So that requires an extraordinary effort in terms of commitment from the cooperative group, from the leadership of the cooperative group, like Peter, from all the institutions in the country, all pediatric oncologists, when they see a pediatric cancer, as Peter said, you know, what is the trial? Where can I enroll this patient? I know that that's an effort the institutions need to put, the physicians need to put, and that applies to all the cancers that we take care of. So this is the first point I wanted to make, just put that in perspective. So that's the extreme, the true rare cancers, but then the common pediatric cancers suffer of the same, you know, sarcomas, osteosarcomas, Wilms tumors, lymphomas, etc. So think about how difficult it is to design these clinical trials and how much effort we put into that. So we do not forget any single one of those, and we try to come up with a meaningful, hypothesis-driven clinical trial for those. So that's the first point. The second point is that, you know, pediatric cancer is kind of it's a disease of the very young, right? The median age of pediatric cancer is around 6 or 7 years of age. So that means that a significant proportion of cancer patients are younger than six. So, and if you look at the every year in the life of a child, you know, you see how cancers cluster in the first 2 or 3 years of life. This is particularly important when we talk about the rare cancers, the ones that I deal with. Actually, all these kids are very young. You know, many of these kids don't even speak, right? So you have these, run these clinics, and at the end of the day, you haven't talked to any of your patients, right? And so that's, but that's the clinical trials that we have to develop. So hepatoblastoma, since we're talking about that, young kids, 2, 3, 4 years of age, retinoblastoma, the same, et cetera, et cetera. So think about how to develop these clinical trials when particularly for some of them, we need to apply new paradigms or bring new agents that basically are being investigated in adults, right? How to transfer that, jumping all these hurdles and go to the younger ages, just even bypassing the older patients, right? So that's a challenge that we have oftentimes. The third point I wanted to make as well is, you know, when we talk about rare cancers, sarcomas, etc., for at least for the numbers or for the diseases that fall into the kind of the left side of the bell curve, some of these cancers are actually adult cancers that happen to occur in children, and that's an interesting phenomenon. That's telling us a lot from a biology point of view, Well, let's think about melanoma, for example, or colon carcinoma, right? And so for some of these cancers, we need to really think how to, you know, apply all the lessons learned on adult trials. And just as an example, you know, vemurafenib was approved for melanoma a long time ago. I cannot even remember when, right? And we still try to get that for kids with melanoma. And we still have children with metastatic melanoma, right? And yet we were never able to bring the pediatric age groups to the adult clinical trials when the disease is exactly the same. And that's a challenge that we always need to overcome. The same is happening right now with the PD-1 inhibitors. You were talking about that earlier, and you will talk about that later. So the PD-1 inhibitors have already gone moved very fast into the approval process. We still have to develop the phase 1 trials in pediatrics when the patients that could benefit the most are exactly the same, a metastatic patient with melanoma. So that's an interesting phenomenon that we need to be able to bridge in pediatric oncology. But then you have the others that are not really like adult cancers occurring in pediatrics, for which we really need to develop new ideas. So some of these true pediatric cancers, many of the sarcomas, many of the rare cancers, neuroblastomas, Peter pointed out, are really, you know, pediatric cancers that call for unique solutions, right? That you can really not use what has been learned from adults. And interestingly, pediatric cancers offer very interesting biology as well, that therefore will lead the field to a whole different direction that probably we cannot just extrapolate from what we have learned from adult clinical trials. So, you know, that was the second point I wanted to make. And maybe the third point I wanted to make as well is the biology, right? As Peter mentioned and Mike mentioned as well. So in pediatrics, we are not wasting our time either, but we just really try to characterize our diseases the best way we can. And so we really have made a major effort over the last 3 or 4 years to characterize all the pediatric cancers from a genomic standpoint. So there has been whole genome, next generation sequencing studies on almost every single pediatric cancer as well. And we have learned that actually pediatric cancers are very different from adult cancers. Adult cancers are very rich in genetic events, as you very well know. Pediatric cancers tend to be a little bit more flat or boring, so we need to really explore epigenomics, for example. So again, pediatric cancer has to take a different route that cannot just follow whatever it's being learned from adults. So that means that we need to develop different paradigms for precision medicine than what is being developed for adults. We are also working on, you know, an equivalent of the MATCH trial that it's, as you know, the MATCH trial has been developed quite successfully for adults. We need to develop a similar initiative, and we are working on that, and Peter is leading that, and he may talk about that later as well, to develop that specifically for pediatrics. But that, again, will call for a new way of getting drugs down the pipeline, because we cannot, you know, if we characterize the diseases genomically, we really need to match those with the best agents. So that will be a new frontier that we will have to cross quite soon as well. So, and the final point I wanted to make, and then we can just get back to this, is going back to the clinical trial discussion that we had at the beginning of my intervention. So, you know, Peter already mentioned that we are curing a good number of our patients, right? Close to 80% of children with cancer are cured, and yet we have problems with toxicity, and toxicity is acute toxicity and long-term toxicity. So we are kind of bringing our clinical trials right now to that point of trying to evaluate least toxic approaches. So therapy reduction now, it's basically at the forefront of clinical trial design. And as new agents are being incorporated, that would be particularly important so that we can start de-escalating with the classic kind of drugs and agents. And that also, you know, accounts for the new concepts in applying the cure model, right, for clinical trials. So we don't look at event-free survival or events in general, but the cure overall. And that's a good model for us to follow when we try to reduce toxicity, look at the long-term goal of our clinical trials to cure as many children as possible. So that was a way kind of to introduce a little bit the challenges and the solutions that we have identified for pediatric cancers. But again, these are very small children, very few cases of each, and yet every single one of these diseases deserves, the best of us in trying to find the best agents, the best clinical trial design, and the best outcomes. And so that's kind of a challenging field for all of us. And the last point, I keep saying that will be the last point, but the last point is international. International collaborations are extremely important to us, extremely important. When we talk about numbers below the hundreds, and yet we want to come up with a clinical trial, basically what COG is doing right now under the leadership of Peter is just really exploring international collaboration. So COG collaborating with other cooperative groups. Peter already mentioned we are in Australia, New Zealand. Now we want to actually collaborate with other cooperative groups, particularly for the rare cancers or for the most common cancers that we are starting to subdivide in genetic categories. So developing international clinical trials is extremely complicated, as you very well know, and I don't think that we have figured out the best way to do it, particularly because the regulatory environment is so complex. And that's just for a phase 3 or a randomized phase 3 trial. Now think about getting an IND and getting a new agent into the equation, and we do have that. So we have a new trial that is an international trial with an IND that needs to open in Japan, or hopefully will open in Japan, working with a cooperative group in Japan. So that's extremely complicated. I know adult cooperative groups are also doing that, but in pediatrics, where the numbers are much smaller, it's a little bit more difficult to justify the expense by the NCI, by the government, etc., and the regulatory support for that. It's extremely expensive. So, but anyway, just the last point I wanted to make is that international collaborations are key for us. Yeah. And that's...
Thanks, Carlos. So I'd like to come back to Meredith Chuck to put a little bit of framework around what's going on in policy to incent drug developers to take on pediatric drug development programs, and also, what's going on with the evaluation and approval of these programs.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate the invitation to come here. I work in the sarcoma and melanoma division at the FDA, but I am a pediatric oncologist, so I am involved in a lot of the pediatric goings-on at the FDA and certainly have a special place in my heart for pediatrics, so I'm happy to give you an overview of the regulatory and the legislative environment that exists for pediatric oncology and also how that applies to rare disease as well. So there are two sort of main pieces of legislation when people talk about pediatric drug development. These are not oncology specific, but just to let you know that the Pediatric Research Equity Act, or PREA, is the mandated evaluation of drugs in pediatrics for safety and efficacy. And anytime a sponsor submits an application for a new indication, a change in dosage form, active ingredient regimen, or route of administration, PREA is triggered that they need to submit a pediatric assessment plan to study that drug in pediatrics for informing the label, giving providers some more information about that drug. The caveat to that is that PREA is indication specific. So if you're evaluating a drug in colon cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, lung cancer, any of the common sort of adult cancers, really don't have any relevance in pediatric oncology. So we wouldn't necessarily want that drug studied because they won't have the patient. So there are waivers that can be obtained for that And PREA is also not apply when a drug has an orphan designation indication as well. So while PREA has been helpful in getting some information into the pediatric labels for drugs that are not oncology specific, it's really been very minimally helpful, if really at all, for pediatric oncology, because many of those indications are not relevant in pediatrics, and then many of the adult oncology indications have orphan drug designations. So oftentimes they are appropriately given waivers for those drugs. If there happens to be an indication that is relevant in the pediatric population, sponsors do need to submit a pediatric study plan assessing how they will evaluate that drug in pediatrics. And if they want a waiver, that waiver has to be at the same time, and that's around the end of phase two, part of the development program. So PREA is sort of the mandate. People talk about PREA and BBCA, which is the Best Pharmaceuticals for Children Act, as sort of the carrot and the stick. So PREA is the stick. That's the mandate. But really where we try and leverage drug development for pediatric oncology is with BPCA. It is a voluntary program, so this is not something that that the companies have to do. But the other thing is it's not indication specific. So if there's a drug that's being developed where there is a scientific rationale that it could be beneficial in pediatric oncology, oftentimes the sponsor will come in to ask the FDA for a proposal for a written request under BPCA, and that's how those studies are conducted. There is a financial incentive under BPCA, so this is sort of the carrot part of that. There's an extra 6 months of marketing exclusivity that's attached to not only this particular indication, but any moiety of the drug. But the caveat to that is that there has to be patent protection or marketing exclusivity existing. So this means that a lot of these drugs, you have to think about the pediatric studies earlier on in development while there's still patent protection or market exclusivity that's attached to the drug. And again, these trials are conducted under a written request from the FDA. Just very briefly, the Orphan Drug Act, I think probably people are more familiar with less than 200,000 persons in the U.S., and as Carlos mentioned, that's really most of pediatric or all of pediatric oncology. And then the benefits for that are, again, are the potential for a marketing exclusivity, grant money, some tax credits, and other financial incentives that can be leveraged for drugs that are developed for pediatric oncology. I just added a couple of information purposes, some links to guidances. There's for the pediatric study plan guidances, information about the PREA guidance as well, qualifying for exclusivity. As Peter mentioned, the Creating Hope Act, the Rare Pediatric Disease Voucher Program, there was recently a draft guidance published about that. And again, this is a voucher that can be transferred. It is given for a company who develops a drug specifically for a pediatric indication. There can't be an accompanying adult indication at that time. But that voucher can be used for any subsequent application, either by that sponsor or transferred to another sponsor, for and is guaranteed priority review by the FDA. So that shortens the time clock 4 months in terms of a review time. So certainly that can translate into some monetary incentive as well. And then there are also the last two are just the pediatric product development at the FDA and also rare disease development as well. Those are the end of the slides, but I wanted to sort of touch on two things that Carlos had mentioned about adolescents and the difficulty with conducting clinical trials after adult indications or after the drug has already been approved in adults for diseases that are very similar in biology in adults and pediatrics. And, you know, one of the things that we have actually been trying to encourage companies is to really open up those early trials for adolescents at the time of the early development program. There's really no reason. There have been published reports looking at pharmacokinetics. There's, you know, people have concerns about safety, and obviously safety is something that needs to be to watch very closely. But in terms of the drug exposure for adolescents in the 12 to 18 age group compared to adults, there's really very minimal difference when you look at age or weight, based dosing. So our hope is that companies will look at enrolling those adolescents earlier in their development programs onto adult trials. And certainly, you know, that is something we encourage. I've spoken to other groups, and there has always been the concern that maybe, you know, FDA would not encourage this, and actually this is something that we think would help patients access these drugs sooner as well. So that's something that we hope will help with the changing landscape as well. And then also, Carlos mentioned the international collaboration, and Peter also mentioned with the PIPs. We are starting to see a lot of these pediatric development plans earlier and earlier, oftentimes at the phase one point, at where the indications in pediatrics are often not known or not well thought out, just because there's a little bit unclear about what the relevance would be in pediatric oncology, and that makes it challenging for us as well in terms of issuing these written requests, because our desire is really for a pediatric development program, not simply a single phase one study to satisfy the provisions of a written request. So, you know, we do have regular conference calls and regular interactions with EMA to try and to talk about the drugs that are coming up for PIPs and to see about at least having complementary programs, not necessarily identical. There are challenges with standards of care that may not make all of the studies possible exactly the same in the U.S. And in Europe. But certainly we understand that with rare tumors and with a limited patient population, to be most efficient about studying these drugs, that international collaboration really is essential. And certainly we encourage that and are hopeful that for at least for our part of it and looking at written requests, that that's something that we would be able to have complementary programs as well to further these agents.
Okay, thanks, Meredith. I just wanted to pause there. Were any questions in the audience at this point? Okay. Okay, so next I'd like to move on to hear what, you know, the industry is doing and what sort of initiatives are ongoing within large biopharma companies that can ensure access of novel therapies to children. So first I'd like to introduce Mao Zhizhong from the Global Development Team Leader of Pediatric Oncology at Genentech to hear a little bit about what you're doing.
Hi. I'm Mao Zhizhong. I'm the Global Development Team Leader of Pediatric Oncology and Genentech Roche. And I'm really happy to be here and to discuss with you on the pediatric oncology development. So as we heard from Meredith, Peter, and Carlos, that I think we all agree with the basic statement that patients or our kids with cancer, they do not really have timely access to safe and efficacious drug. There are many external and internal factors. We heard already that the pediatric cancer patients are really rare. Also, there are multiple programs that are competing for the same pool of patients. And also internally for industry, we are often organized by molecules. And the pediatric development is really as really low priority in many cases. And often we do pediatric development at the very end of our drug cycle, maybe at the time of even at the phase three approval, we are then asked the question, do we have to do pediatric development? Do we have a waiver? If we have a waiver, so let's forget about it. Let's wait for the next indication. Until at the moment saying, okay, you have a glioblastoma where you have a requirement and say, okay, let's have a pediatric study. And then after you finish study, normally the study can take very, very long time to enroll. And you already lost incentives where we mentioned, like the six months extension of your patent or exclusivity. So this is really not working. So what we have worked on in Roche Genentech in the last couple of years are two things. First of all, we said we need a dedicated team, a team that really has a pediatric expertise to really can look at the, our portfolio across the whole portfolio and do a portfolio strategy. So we got approval of that from our senior management. Now we have a dedicated team with more than 25 people with that pediatric expertise to really working on the pediatric oncology development. The second thing we are saying is, let's change our mindset. Not saying what do we have to do. let's ask the question, what's a right for children? What's the right thing to do? So that's why I say to transition from a molecule-centric approach to a portfolio approach. So exactly what we do, first of all, we talk about this for adolescent. Now within the company, we are pushing our adult program to really include our adolescent patient in our adult early programs from 12 years to 18 years old. So they can have the early access to our drugs. Second of all, we want to start our pediatric study much sooner. So instead of waiting for phase 3, let's start maybe after the adult phase 1 study. And also, let's start about the formulation work. Let's start a discussion about our preclinical treatment. Also, let's start saying, okay, we open our pediatric patient study from 0, from birth, basically, to 30 years old, because there are some young adults had actually pediatric tumors. And then specifically to the pediatric study itself, let's just forget about our pediatric obligation from adults. Let's basically look at our mechanism of action of the drug itself to see whether there's any potential that this drug can work for children. So just like what we do in adults, we look at the biology, look at the mechanism of action of the drug, and then enroll patients from all those tumor types. Collect some PK, collect some safety, determine the right dose, and then if we see some signal, we do cohort expansion to further get additional information. And then we decide, okay, what we should do for a pivotal trial. So we call this phase 1 and the phase 2 portion to collect the PK safety and some early efficacy data, the matrix. So the matrix here is really provide your framework, basically. Has two interesting, very interesting aspects about this matrix. First of all, it really has some operational efficiency. So we can have this, you can just imagine, you have a clinical trial where you can include multiple drugs in multiple disease types. You can have this master protocol, master IND submission, master CTA submission, also master contract with our key academia groups to help you enroll patients and help you to make a decision where to move forward. So a second aspect from the matrix is this is really about molecule and disease prioritization. So just imagine from the matrix, you are going to have data from multiple molecules and from multiple diseases. It's impossible to really have pivotal study for every disease in every molecule. Think about the melanoma. There's just so few patients. How can these companies have the same obligation and have the, really a big set of phase 3 studies? It's impossible. So this is not really working for the kids. So what we do here, we are saying is, okay, we start from a mechanism of action drug, we open our net and test whether there's any efficacy signal. And then we really, from the matrix itself, to really pick the one indication where we can go for a pivotal trial. And then from other signals, we can collaborate with our academia groups to further gather more data. So I think this is really important for the company to really survive here, to make it really working for kids. So what we do is we have a discussion with our agencies, both and with FDA and with EMA and PDCO. And I think the discussion is really, really helpful, and we are having very great progress. And another thing I want to share with you is our first two molecules we're going to put in the matrix is our PD-L1 molecule and also cobimetinib. So we're expecting the first patient in for these two molecules in summer of this year. So this is really our commitment as a company to these patients, that we want to do what's right for the patients and do we know what children need next. Thank you.
Thank you, Maggie. So Peter, I'd like to hear what how Amgen is approaching this as well.
Right, so what I will try to cover, by the way, my name is Peter Sandor, heading global marketing for oncology at Amgen. So I will cover a little bit the commercial marketing and market aspects of rare diseases, especially pediatric diseases, driven by two things. One, we really believe in that those patients who has high unmet need diseases, be it pediatric patient population or adult patient population, they need to get access to the treatment and molecules what they develop. And also we had experience in the past and recent past, both in supportive care medicines as well as therapeutic oncology, how well doesn't fit this type of rare disease in a large biopharma organization. Because if you think about how the commercial organizations are built in the large companies targeting large amount of stakeholders, physicians, or payers, it's really a hierarchy organization going out with properly designed messages, going through the market broadly. What is needed for a pediatric rare cancer disease is really a small group, very different stakeholders in there. As it was discussed before, many times those are not even the patients actually who are the decision makers on treatments, but the parents. And just if you think about, again, coming back to the commercial organization, how it is set up, in rare diseases where there are 20, 100, 200 patients out there, the CEO can know all the company, all the patients actually and parents in person and know the names. That's a very different type of internal culture and internal organization or mindset what is needed to deal with these diseases. Back to your point, one of the ways to think about this is to create organizations inside of the larger organization which is truly focused on the rare diseases, understands the patient needs or the parent's needs, including also the payers or the cooperative groups who are running clinical development in most of the cases. Because just thinking about the whole commercialization process, bringing drugs from very early stage to the market and then follow them on the market, these type of diseases require very different approach. Just one small anecdote. When we started to think about a pediatric indication, first indication for one of our innovative molecules, we sat down with a set of opinion leaders, heads of cooperative groups globally. And what we have heard at this meeting that there are 200 patients, all of them are clinical studies, and in 2018 we may have a slot for you to run your clinical study, which is great for the patients as they have access to drugs. But it also describes what Peter talked to or Carlos talked to earlier. Most of these patients are already in clinical studies. Well, it also means a very different, if you wish, market or competitive set. Biopharma companies in these rare diseases compete not necessarily with another company's drug, but compete with the clinical studies which are ongoing, just to get to the point where the drug can be proven in this disease area. Another changing point that in some areas, at least, the competition is growing very heavily. If you just think the CD19, CD20, CD22 positive hematologic malignancies, Amgen's Blincyto is the first drug which was launched on December 5th last year, but there is a whole set of other drugs coming into the same disease. I think Novartis is one of the frontrunners, but others coming with very similar technologies and approaches in these diseases. So it's even becoming competitive on the market, which raises another question around access and payer environment. We have heard several times, primarily outside of the United States, that because of the high unmet need and lack of standard of care, there is no standard comparator. So how will you assess, how will we as a payer assess and evaluate your drug in this disease situation to justify the value what it brings to the market? So all in all, those diseases require a fairly different approach throughout the commercialization as well as on the commercial setting, building more focused, more patient-centric organization, really understanding what the patient need or the parents need or the payer needs are, even more explicitly and more directly contacting them in the pre-market phase or on the post-market phase, which raises another interesting question where in most of the markets, the pharmaceutical industry and the activities what we do on the market are highly regulated, both from regulatory as well as legal perspective. And many of these activities which would be required or are required to prepare those patient groups or get access and bring the information there or collect the information from them is really sometimes on borderline or gray zone or getting into potential issues with regulators. So those many of these activities would require actually safe harbors for the industry to properly conduct them. So again, I think a lot to talk about this and a lot to do, and very few have been done in the past. So really glad to hear what Peter and Carlos is doing or what the regulators are trying to build around these diseases, because the unmet need is there and we need to find solutions.
Thanks, Peter. So any questions now from the audience? Anybody developing pediatric oncology drugs? Oh, here's one.
Is there any impetus behind... Oh, thank you. Is there any impetus at the NIH level to create a pediatric cancer genome atlas? That would seem to give us lots of new avenues and perhaps find drivers for pediatric mutations, which tend to be far different than adult tumor types.
So there is a similar program. It's not quite the scope. It's called the Target Initiative. The Target Initiative looked at five high-risk cancers and did a breadth of genomic studies from exome to whole genome to methylation status. So it's on a different scale. But again, I think that where the data is pointing is as far as if we were to look at all our cancers right now and look at the landscape of drugs that are targetable and that targets that are druggable and that are available, it's probably somewhere in the 10 to 20% of childhood cancers where there's going to be a pretty strong rationale. So the sequencing right now is probably not going to hold the solution. There isn't quite the global strategy as there was with the Atlas, but there are some programs.
So I just had a question. You know, listening to the conversation and the different initiatives that were presented, I just had a question. You know, is this a consistent, like the matrix approach to developing pediatric drugs and what COG is doing? Is this something that's consistent, or is this conflict? Or
well, I can start. And so hats off to Genentech that they have a pediatric team, and it's a real team. I've actually met many of the members of the team, and it's a real effort. And one of our challenges historically has been, when does industry allow us to get into the pediatric space? Meaning, when will they give us access to the investigational drug? Historically, it would often be at end of phase three or during phase four, drugs on the market. That's clearly, puts us a decade behind adult drug development. It has shifted with the regulations and the incentives. I think for some high-priority drugs, we really do need to be in the clinic at end of phase one. Others, perhaps later at end of phase two. But if you're only starting to talk about it when you're in phase three, then you're really coming quite late to the game. So the Matrix trial, and I think one thing that's different in pediatric early phase development that adults at the Matrix trial parallels is our phase two studies almost always have multiple strata. So we don't launch, we don't have a phase two trial in breast and a separate one in colon, a separate one in lung. We generally say, well, which pediatric diseases are relevant for this drug? Overall, if they're solid tumors, we'll have a multi-strata phase two, which is what the Matrix is about. The risk that we see from the EMA, one of the challenges that hasn't been solved, is that it is a very drug-centric view of the world. And the melanoma story is a classic one where there were five PIPs in pediatric melanoma. There were more PIPs in patients. And so we are worried that what the highest priority for a disease may be is not always reflected in what the regulatory agencies say ought to happen. It's an evolving landscape, but I don't think there, in early phase, there's a real conflict. I don't know, Najah, if you have other views on that.
Yes, I think in terms of back to your question, whether we are doing something really different from what academia or the COG group has been doing, I think basically the same principle, right? We just do as what adults would do. You have a drug, you understand what the drug supposed to be working, and then look at, okay, what are the potential tumor types you want to work on? And you collect some phase one data, and then further define, saying, okay, what are the next tumor, not the next, what will be the right tumor type to go to keep working on, right? So this is exactly what we will do for pediatrics. That's what is for the matrix. So what's special about the matrix is really saying, okay, we want to add, we have these specific rules and different gates, like gate one after phase one and gate two after our having different cohort after we receive some response rate. So for each tumor type, for example, we will say, what is the historical response rate? What will be our target response rate? Would it be considered as clinically meaningful? And if we pass that, and then if the feasibility okay, then let's move on to pivotal. So really, we're adding these gates, adding gating criteria to help make our decision more rigorous. And this way, we'll also give assurance to our health authorities saying this is the right approach to go forward. And in the end, they can agree, okay, this is the one study we want. I mean, back to the question is like, okay, we started this discussion with the health authorities much sooner. And for example, for the matrix, we are going to go through this qualification procedure with EU and likely some similar procedure with FDA to really saying, okay, this is the right approach. You agree with our gating criteria, with our different gates, with our endpoint. And in the end, then when we really go through this process, you are going to agree this is a study we are going to do for pivotal. And after we finish the pivotal study, and we are going to get our incentives. I think this is make sure that our model can really be sustainable in the long run. Yeah.
And is there agreement among like endpoints? Is everybody using the same endpoints? And is it something that Meredith would endorse as being an appropriate endpoint? Across these different platforms?
Right. I think that's part of the challenge. I mean, Peter talked about in pediatric oncology, and Carlos mentioned too, I mean, a lot of these studies have survival endpoints because we do so well. So, the goal is cure. It's not necessarily response rate. Now, it depends on the tumor, obviously. For refractory disease or more aggressive disease, the bar doesn't necessarily need to be survival. But I think that certainly for early looks at whether an agent is going to be effective, looking at response rate and looking at a fairly high bar for response rate in a refractory population is very reasonable. Whether or not that leads to a regulatory approval at that point, I think is certainly debatable, and that depends upon the stage of the disease. It depends upon the disease itself. It depends upon available therapy. So those are all conversations that we are interested in having, certainly in the earlier time points. And that way, as things evolve, then we can have the conversations about, well, what is your pivotal trial going to look like? What does the academic community accept as a rational endpoint? What's clinically meaningful? And can we have international collaboration if we're looking at a rare tumor type with a limited patient population? And can we have those conversations earlier? So I think, we don't necessarily get into the regulatory design early on, but I think we're very interested in having those conversations to see what the process is going to look like.
I think that's exactly our point is we really need a really close collaboration with our regulators and also with academia groups, like which ones are acceptable, which ones really clinically meaningful. And for exactly in our early look, say for matrix trial, we're really trying to look for the signals. And then probably in some tumor types, response rate will be something really good endpoint for that. But for some specific tumor types, then maybe their survival rate is so low, maybe it's really reasonable to look at maybe 1 year survival rate or maybe even 6 months. So it really depends on different tumor types, also depends on the line of therapy.
In some respects, I think in pediatrics, the bar is certainly higher when it comes to a go, no-go decision. We don't have enough patients to, if we don't have a clear signal in the right population, to explore looking for lower signals. So we commit a certain number of children to phase two. We obviously want to have an enriched population when we can to maximize the likelihood of a response. But if the signal's not there, we generally don't go exploring, I don't don't want to say random, but random combinations with active drugs if we don't have a clear signal. We do randomized phase 2 trials in combination, but again, the bar is relatively high. We have to have a relatively high degree of confidence that there is a positive signal because we cannot commit to more than phase 1, phase 3 in any disease at any one time. And generally, we're looking at a 4 to 6 year periods for phase 3. So the bar is very high to get into phase 3, and we generally have go, no go with pretty high criteria at phase 2.
And I want to add a point is at the same time, I think regulatory is really concerned that we are dropping molecules too early. Like if we put a really high bar and say we drop everything down work. So what we're trying to do here is we start from a single agent activity to see if there's any single agent activity. If they don't pass a reasonable bar, and then we are thinking about, okay, whether we can park that molecule for a while and see whether there's combination, and then put the combination back to the matrix and then test again. So really our commitment really look at the drugs in a very systematic way to help identify the promising therapy.
So, Carlos, can you add any more like flavor around any real world examples? Anything that either was approved or something that's in development, that, and how some of these issues play out?
Yeah, well, I wanted to highlight that yes, even though we have mentioned that there are many hurdles that we still need to jump, I think that yes, I see the same. You know, the work that Genentech has done across the board more and more, right? That there is more kind of an open forum for discussion on when to move pediatric cancer drugs to pediatrics earlier. And I think that most of the pharmaceutical companies now have pediatric oncologists in many of these leadership positions, so trying to advocate for pediatrics. I think it's still difficult, though, to have, you know, a unique drug matched to a unique pediatric cancer. Peter mentioned the anti-GD2. I think that we have a few other diseases, say, you know, not midline carcinoma, for example, right? Not midline carcinoma is a cancer that is extremely rare, but it's defined by a very unique alteration in BRD4 or kind of the BET class of molecules. And so we know that there is a class of agents, the BET inhibitors, that actually can induce differentiation in these undifferentiated carcinomas. So this is a malignancy that is predominantly pediatrics, even though now it's crossing the adolescent and the young adult age group. And yet we still haven't been able to bring this down to pediatrics. So we have had to really develop the trials in adults first, right? And then once the drug has already gone through the first couple of levels, then in the phase one, then start opening that to pediatrics when we have seen many children that actually define the disease. So the disease was defined in children, go past and die because they would never be able to access this class of agents, right? So I think there is still a lot to learn and a lot of kind of many of these steps to optimize.
Well, maybe I can give two quick examples of of models that have been successful in different ways. Crizotinib, the ALK inhibitor, in our phase one, and we moved into phase one right at the end of the adult phase one, and right as the non-small cell lung cancer story was breaking. Seven of the first eight children with anaplastic large cell lymphoma, complete responses. At all dose levels. Haven't seen that since Gleevec in CML. So we very quickly went from phase one to front line. Now, this space became busy. Brentuximab vedotin, also efficacious in ALCL in young adults. What we were able to do is we're able to partner with both companies with some NCI support, and we have both drugs in a frontline trial. Two different sponsors, two different targeted agents with high efficacy, all in one trial. The other last example we'll give is a challenge we had with IGF-1 antibodies, where the only signal, reproducible signal, was in Ewing sarcoma. There were a lot of people in the space, and a lot of people left that space. the same challenges that our medical oncology colleagues have. We didn't have and don't have a good biomarker for which children with Ewing sarcoma respond. But there we partnered with the NCI and Amgen to try to de-risk it, where the NCI stepped in to help supply Amgen's drug to support a trial that's now ongoing in children with Ewing's.
And Peter Sender, I just wanted to leave you with sort of like the last comment on this. Can you talk a little bit more about, I also think of Blincyto as being a pediatric drug, but it doesn't have a pediatric indication yet. I mean, can you talk a little bit more about, you know, the effort for the pediatric program?
Well, the drug was developed parallel, almost parallel in adult and pediatric. There is a time lag between the approval given that the clinical data or the clinical study is running or ran slower in the pediatric indications. Plus, there are dosing and side effect related issues, but I'm sure Peter can talk more about these. We will have the pediatric indication. We expect the data very soon this year, and then follow this with a full approval in pediatric indication as well. As we see, when the drug got the approval, there was a significant amount of compassionate use request for kids in relapsed refractory ALR.
But we're doing a randomized phase 3 with Amgen in COG right now with Blina. That's underway.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm getting the hook here on time, so I think that lunch is waiting next.
Actually, we have a little change of plans. We're having the first immunotherapy panel now, and we're having lunch at 1:15. I hope that works for everybody.
Okay.
Thanks. So
all right. Well, I'd like
here.
To thank the panel. It was a great discussion. You know, I think there's still a lot, you know, for us to learn about this space, and you know, we look forward to working with you guys moving forward.